21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD hanging out here somewhere, and our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner, and our engineer is Sean Roman. Well, our first guest is Stephen Diner, author of Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All, and is published by our friends at Hampton Roads. And notes, this visionary work by the founder of the Shift Network inspires hope that America can grow beyond its current challenges to manifest its noblest destiny. Author Stephen Diner shows that by returning to the sacred principles cherished by America's forefathers, and we can create a transpartisan pragmatic approach to social reform and national reconciliation that goes beyond left and right. And in so doing, we can evolve beyond America's polarized political landscape and address urgent environmental, political, and economic issues as a united people. And as I said, Stephen Diner, author of Sacred America, Sacred World, is going to be joining us. And I should note this. He is a noted social entrepreneur and visionary political strategist, is the founder and CEO of the Shift Network, a leading global provider of online transformational courses and trainings. He was previously a senior staffer at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Boy, does that bring back memories, where he was the driving force behind the Shift in Action program at the Esalen Institute, where he directed and helped to create the Center for Theory and Research, a think tank for scholars, researchers, and teachers to explore human potential frontiers. A graduate of Stanford University, Diner also holds a master's in East-West Psychology from the California Institute of Integral Sciences. He is a member of the prestigious Transformational Leadership Council and Evolutionary Leaders Groups and author of Radical Spirit, Spiritual Writings from the Voices of Tomorrow, New Library, 2002. Diner resides in one of my favorite places to live, San Francisco Bay Area, with his family. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
Well, it serves you right.
It serves me right.
No, it serves us right, actually. Really, I enjoyed your work tremendously. This is an important work. Couldn't have come at a better time. You must have had your karma together this time, brother.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I definitely navigate my life through trying to tap in to get a sense of higher guidance on things, and it was very clear it needed to come out this year. It was not at all convenient to try to make that happen. I had a lot on my plate and with the company and a whole variety of other things, and so I had to do some hustling. But now that the race is shaping up on the national level, and just the level of, polarization in our country is just reaching extremes. It's more and more clear why I was getting the tap on the shoulder to get this out.
Yeah, thank heavens you did. You write that America has sacred purpose. What is it?
Well, you can see it it's obviously coded in our founding documents and some of our principles. I mean, the way I look at it is things, when we say in the Constitution that we want to form a more perfect union, we didn't say we wanted to create a more perfect nation, a more perfect union. There's a deeper principle at work, which is than just a political mission in a way. It's also a spiritual mission. It's about creating larger wholes, like coming together in a new way, in new configurations. And you can also see it in E Pluribus Unum, which I think is a very profound metaphysical statement. It means out of many, one. And so it goes beyond the unification of 13 colonies into one nation. It's really an ever-evolving mission to create larger wholes and more unity, and particularly unity within diversity. This balance of unity and diversity is really at the core of how do we unleash the ingenuity and human potential of the human race. Because if we're so stuck in our individuality and our separateness, that's when we end up in war and friction and misunderstanding and lack of misunderstanding. If we're all blended together into one big unity, then it tends to wash out the diversity that actually is the engine of creativity.
Sure.
So it's this balance of unity and diversity, and we get called to do that on still higher levels all the time. And we've obviously had some areas where we baked in some areas that were not at all about unity, and that, you know, with slavery and not having women not having the right to vote. And slowly over time, we've had to create a more perfect union and lead towards these larger wholes. And the reason I called the book Sacred America, Sacred World, is that I see that what we're moving towards is ultimately a sacred worldview where we see the divinity, the beauty, the power. We love everything and everyone. It's Native Americans see the sacred in all things. And so it becomes a way of seeing the world where we're looking deeper than surfaces, and surfaces are often more separative. And we're seeing that there's this kind of unitive fabric that binds us all. And you can see that on environmental levels, but you can also see it on spiritual levels in some of the leading-edge science at places like the Institute of Noetic Sciences. So there's a way in which America's spiritual mission has to do with the creation of these higher wholes and the demonstration of a template for how that we can live together in a way that's harmonious, that's ultimately creative, and that maximizes freedom while also designs a society that is really working for the greatest number. So, you know, I think it's very exciting what we've been tasked with, and it's important to reconnect with that, because we can get very discouraged, bogged down, disenchanted, and a lot of people I know, and myself included, have gone through phases where we'll get really disenchanted with America altogether. We might travel overseas and we feel kind of embarrassed to be an American because some of the foreign policies and some of what we witness on a government level can become so out of sync with who we mm-hmm. really feel ourselves to be that we then create some sense of separation. But I feel like it's important that we reconnect with that deeper dimension of America and really relate to our country with love, not with a blind love that's not looking at faults and not looking at places where we've made major mistakes and looking into our shadow. That's an important part of our growth, but it's the kind of love that dares us to grow it to another level, that we honor the roots, and then we also hold a powerful vision of possibility where we go far beyond where we are right now, and we really demonstrate an even much more radiant, creative, powerful, and beautiful template for human civilization.
Isn't it interesting that E Pluribus Unum, out of many one, has 13 letters, and those 13 letters and the meaning of E Pluribus Unum and number 13 is rebirth and regeneration, so that within the sacred symbols of our country, especially when you take a look at America's Great Seal and you see, I remember one time I was sitting with Jimi Hendrix on a little street corner in New York City, and we were struggling with this pyramid, Nyaya, triangle, and the mottos at that time. This was 1968, and we knew something was important about this pyramid, Nyaya, triangle, but we clearly couldn't put our hands on it, because when you went through traditional historical books about it, they really did not know the interpretations, etc. But it's just amazing today that when I think of Jimmy, I think of him really so concerned about that eye in the triangle. And then, it was about 15 years ago, I was given a book. Inside this book, I found his drawings of the pyramid and the eye in the triangle and also Kabbalistic letters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an extraordinary soul, and unfortunately, he was never asked to talk about any of this. The media, unfortunately, just ignored it.
Mm.
And that is too bad, because it's taken us a long time now. I think we've probably been overstuffed with the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and National Geographic, at least I have, in doing shows on America's symbols, dealing with the pyramid and the Nyaya triangle. But at that time, back there in 68... it really meant a lot to us that there was a part of our country we did not understand, and it seemed to us to be far more, far deeper than we ever supposed. And I think that that's what changed a lot of us. Regardless of what our country was doing, we realized that we did have a destiny, just as you said.
Yeah. And, you know, something that was really anticipated for Sir Francis Bacon, who was one of the preeminent minds and scientists of the, I think it was the 15th century, basically, or 16th perhaps, who strongly encouraged people to go to America to create the new Atlantis. And so that became part of the mythology of actually why there was this pilgrimage to America, because there was a sense of, like, it could be a fresh start, and there was a lot of guidance that needed to create. The old social structures and political structures had gotten so ossified and stuck in Europe that there needed to be this outlet for the birthing of a new template or a new pattern. And so, you know, all these people were immigrating with the idea, many of whom coming from Masonic lineages and more esoteric societies, that this was going to be the place that we could make a demonstration of what was possible. And a lot of that gets baked in there, as you know, people don't know that a lot of the grid work of how things are laid out in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of sacred geometry involved in the actual design of the city. So it was designed to be basically to help amplify and align the government with higher forces. And so there's like almost a design baked in to connect with higher consciousness from the beginning. And, you know, I think that I'm not an expert in that area, but I think it's an important area for inquiry to understand both the Western esoteric stream, but then there's also the stream coming out of the Iroquois Confederation. There was really nothing like a federated system, a federal system in Europe at the time. And so, you know, when the five major Iroquois nations had several hundred years before come together in a spirit of peace and created a model of governance that actually had separate nations bound together into one confederation, it was the closest template to what the United States was to become. In fact, Ben Franklin met regularly with Iroquois leaders. There was an Iroquois delegation that actually traveled to the Continental Congress. So there was a really conscious templating of the Iroquois model, which was different than anything people had experienced in Europe.
One piece that was interesting,
it also connects to a book that I know you're connected with the Lady Liberty, is that the piece that we didn't really bake in from the Iroquois was the masculine-feminine balance.
That's right.
With the Iroquois people, they recognized that you needed to have a sort of a balance of powers, not just between branches of government, but between genders, and that created a healthier society. So the sachems were essentially the representatives, the government representatives and decision makers, who were men, but they were chosen by the women and could be removed by the women if they were no longer serving the needs of the tribe. And the women would actually set the agenda, like what the men were to discuss, the sachems were to discuss, that would be set by the women. So the priorities were set, and then the guys would come up with their strategies and figure it out. And if they weren't doing a good job, they could get yanked. And so it created this nice form of gender balance that that helped to ensure a more peaceful federation of nations. And so this was a very influential on the founding of our country. So you've got these two deep streams that are mostly hidden to us as conventional Americans, that, you know, the Native American stream and this kind of deep esoteric Western stream that had come out of Europe. And both were very influential in creating the template of who we are.
So well put. That was so well put. You just won a free trip to Bermuda.
And,
would you like to go back to Bermuda? Well, I don't know. But anyway, but that really meant so many good points there. Thanks for bringing in Bacon here, because he really spent a good deal of money and time and effort making sure that the colonies here succeeded in multiple levels. So I'm so happy that that you're saying what you're saying. Here's the reason why. I've done about 30 or 40 shows on television dealing with these kind of things, and unfortunately they will not allow me to talk about the League of the Iroquois. They will not allow me to talk about the importance of the divine feminine in regards to that. So it's just amazing how, when it gets to that, that most important point, that they are not interested in moving in that direction yet. Hopefully, your book, Sacred America and Sacred World, is going to be one of those things that's going to open the light, I think, a lot more, so that they can realize there's not just two or three people out there thinking about this. There's thousands that are looking for the rebirth of this particular country.
Yeah, and I think you've got your finger on the pulse. That's why I put the Statue of Liberty on the cover, and because she is our most central goddess symbol, that's in many ways been the missing ingredient in our history, is to have a political culture and leadership culture and decision-making culture that it does have masculine-feminine balance. Mm-hmm. I think that the divine feminine aspect is really important to bring in, and just the plain old masculine-feminine balance is enough to recognize. To have a healthy family, it helps to have a loving relationship between masculine and feminine, father and mother. There's that kind of a balance creates a healthier upbringing and ultimately healthier adults. And the same principle applies to our nation. And so what we have now is we have Republican Party tends to be more sourced from the strict father archetype, to use George Lakoff's language. He did a really great analysis showing how a lot of the core value systems on the right tend to be more sourced in the strict father, and then the democratic value systems tend to be sourced more from the nurturing mother. But meanwhile, you have the parties at war with each other, and we're so busy denigrating the other side and demonizing the other side and you know, saying, I can't even hang out with somebody who's a Trump reporter, I can't believe that the person's a Hillary supporter. There's a way in which we've gotten into such polarized camps that it's like being in a family where mom and dad are constantly fighting. So you have, instead of the synergy and the real creative power of the complementarity of masculine and feminine in the culture, we just have like this ongoing squabble, mm-hmm. that is all about denigrating and tearing down the other side. And so that creates a kind of a subliminal trauma in those of us who are watching it, because we want our leaders to get along. We want to have a template of like, what does it actually look like to have at a leadership level for people to have healthy differences, that there's a bond of unity, there's a shared mission, there's a shared sense of commitment to a certain set of ideals, and there's a diversity of political expressions and beliefs and ways of priorities, and that we can kind of hold the whole thing together. So when we weaken the unity part of that equation, so we have less and less unity and more diversity and separation, then we're forced to choose sides in a certain way, and we tend to start getting our information and our media and our facts from one side. We start to socialize with just one side. And that compromises our ability to grow personally and collectively, because we're not learning as much from the other side. We're not really in deep dialogue with the value system on the other side, whichever side of the divide we find ourselves on. And that's also not allowing the higher expression of masculine and feminine coming together is the birth of a child. It can also be the birth of a new kind of culture, a new creativity. So there's a generativity that's lost when the differences of sort of the polarization of gender or the polarization of politics breaks down into civil war.
Yes, indeed. We need to take our first break right about now, Stephen. So hang in there. Our guest, of course, is Stephen Dynan. Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All. Hampton Roads Publishing, TheShiftNetwork.com, TheShiftNetwork.com, and www.sacredamerica.net. You've got to get a copy of this book. It's extremely important. We'll be right back.
Hello there, this is George Martin, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. You know, I think that religion, flying saucers, kinetic energy, transportation, ghosts, paranormal experiences, all these are probably tied up in some form. There are so many things we don't know. There are so many things that we have yet to find out, and I believe that probably when we're dead, we might know about them.
Well, our dear friend Sir George Martin knows about them now. He's obviously passed on to the other side. And when we used to get together, the kind of conversations that we have on 21st Century Radio are the same things that we would talk about all the time. You heard him for the first time ever talk about those things on the air, and we appreciate his confidence in that. Our guest is Stephen Dynan, Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All, Hampton Roads Publishing, theshiftnetwork.com, and www.sacredamerica.net. Okay. There are so many good questions that I have that I'm going dizzy here. Can we go back to the Founding Fathers? Oh, no, wait. Before we do that, I understand that, Stephen, you are in Washington, D.C. right now. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I am here, and I'm doing a couple events tomorrow. One, you can find them at sacredamerica.net, and there's an events tab. One is at the Search for Common Ground offices in DuPont Circle area, and that's 4 to 6 tomorrow. And then at 6:30 p.m. I'm going to be out in Silver Spring at the Meditation Museum. That'll be kind of a fun event. We have Marianne Williamson on remote, and then we're going to have some kirtan and sort of raise the spirit, raise the energy, and then also talk about how do we really have a sacred relationship with politics.
Well, we could use a sacred relationship with politics. It would make one world of difference now.
Yeah, I think it's so important because, you know, when we've been in this long period where we've essentially been witnessing more of a combat culture or in politics, or maybe, at best, sort of a football rivalry, mm-hmm. We basically, it makes it very difficult to show up with our full self. And when we don't show up with our full self, it's often hard to find really real deep truth and wisdom and really, be inspired by the vision of what we're creating. So you end up being far more defended. It's sort of an attack and defend psychology, and that will tend to push a lot of people who are more sensitive and open and more integrated, frankly, and will tend to push them out of the political arena. So you end up with less wisdom and less love and connection in the public sphere, which is exactly where we need it most, because ultimately, to circle back to the Native American tribes, the expectation was that people who were elected to be chiefs or sachems in different tribes were expected to be the wisest and the highest integrity and the most generous people. So you want to have a healthy society, you want to make the political roles desirable to the best people. And so if you're creating a culture where that's scaring away the best people and attracting people who aren't going to be as selfless of leaders, then that's ultimately you're setting the stage for your own demise as a culture. And so that's part of where we see the decline and why we have to turn it around, mm-hmm. because it's not going to improve unless we, the people who are very deeply committed to a more unitive path, are a voice and a force within the election, so that we're working to unify rather than separate and divide and search and destroy.
Yeah, that's the key of unification. The founding fathers were deeply spiritual and highly principled, and I'm so glad that you're educating our country, and actually the world, not just our country, because it's going to surprise a lot of people in other countries, believe me. Are their ideals still driving our country?
Well, I think they are, but it's often a little more subterranean. I think there's a brilliance in the design of the separation of powers and the balance between different branches of government and the freedoms that were built in early. And we also don't want to romanticize. Slavery was baked into the Constitution. Women didn't have the right to vote. There was a lot of inequalities that were built into the society that were part of the original founding. And so it took a while to work out the kinks. We had the Articles of Confederation, which turned into a disaster because there wasn't really any way to organize, to raise enough money and revenue for a central defense, and the interstate exchange was a mess. And so it was like a very buggy operating system, and we had to outgrow that with the Constitution. That took a little while to forge. And so, Thomas Jefferson said that he thought we might need to have a new Constitution every 30 years. Every generation mm-hmm. should sort of write their own Constitution. And I think that that's too extreme, but I think what we do need to do is every generation we have to think through, is this set of documents and codes, is this adequate to the challenges of our day? Are there new challenges that we have to evolve the source code of our civilization to the next level? And so I make the case in the book that we're now in the midst of upgrading the American operating system to a 7.0 operating system, and without going into the actual, you know, the previous versions, but basically I see that the 7.0 version of America is a truly global America. We now have a global internet, we have global finance, we've got global environmental challenge, global culture, everything is global trade. So it's a globalized world that we live in, and that's forcing America to upgrade our operating system to a globally conscious operating system, which is why it's Sacred America, Sacred World. And it forces us to actually, in order for us to thrive, we have to think much more deeply and be much more committed to the thriving of the entire planet. Because, you know, if you get Ebola crops up in West Africa or Zika in South America, whatever it is a biological threat or terrorism or ideological, or if there's a crashed economy, you know, the Brexit is like taking the stock market down. Everything is so much more interconnected than it ever was, that it means we can't actually thrive unless the whole is thriving. So we have to literally up-level our mission to go beyond a nationalistic vision to one where we're really a globally centric vision, where we're really in service to the entire planet. And that leads to a different kind of more trusted leadership when other nations can feel that we're not just advancing our self-interest, we're not just a self-interested empire, but that we're leveraging our leadership to be in service to the larger whole, coming together in peace and sustainability and prosperity. That will allow us to ramp down the defense budget. It will allow us to have a much more prosperous world because we're not going to squander so much on essentially wasted efforts like defense and military don't actually generate long-term value for societies. And so we want to cut that down over time, not in a way that's too idealistic or that it's too, you know, just you have to do it kind of in a measured way, but that we stop squandering as much money on essentially a non-productive activity.
Well, yes, except that we're many times being told that war is a productive activity. I think that's a mistake, and I don't think you're necessarily in favor of it either. What about in our day today? Did the authors of the U.S. Constitution have someone like Trump in mind when they originated the electoral system?
Well, in many ways they did, because they were planning to a system that could hopefully weather storms when you had the rise of more authoritarian kinds of leaders. And I don't want to denigrate Trump. I think part of the importance of a more transpartisan perspective is learn how to have respectful differences. And I can understand why certain people see him as their champion and their candidate. However, you know, it is true that when we look at on a scale of psychology of authoritarian personality and that the sort of the strongman personality of government, that it's just like, I'm going to make all the decisions and I'm going to go in this direction and that direction. He's a long way towards one end of that scale. And, politics has always attracted a lot of people that who have authoritarian personalities. They want to be the big person calling all the shots. And so, you know, the founding fathers were certainly aware of that, and that's why design a system of government that has a mandatory balancing of powers, and so you can't have a situation where you move into a dictatorship. Now, it's not like it's completely perfect. There's always scenarios where you can go in that direction, but it was designed to curb the tendency for things to go off the rails with somebody who was too focused on just centralizing all the decision-making in one place. And we wanted to move away from kings and monarchies and dictators into a democracy. Democracy means sharing power. It means that you have to take the interests of others into account in a deeper way. And so I think that, they were designing the system to be resilient enough to weather people who had a more authoritarian bent to them.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And then, you know, I know you're well aware of the father of our country, George Washington, and his involvement in Freemasonry. And and Jefferson's involvement in the Bible, which is just quite extraordinary. I don't know for sure whether he wrote seven different versions of the Bible in seven different languages, or whether it's five or so. Do you know?
I don't know that. That's an interesting fact.
He was totally focused on only the words. I was going to be a priest at one time, and one of the things that I was really concerned about was the man in the pulpit talking about what Jesus really was teaching, or was he making some of that stuff up? And Jefferson felt the same way, and that's the reason why he only cut out all of the words that Jesus said. If he didn't say it, it's not in his Bible. That, I thought, was a fantastic thing to do, because today, unfortunately, there's some Christians today that have become so extreme that they do not support anything but certain Bibles, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting to note that many of the things that we associate with, you know, just being part of the church, there were a lot of decisions that were political decisions about what made it into the church canon and the official gospels, based upon really nothing but political motivation by I forget the name of the Roman emperor who basically, you probably know.
I probably know.
Yeah,
but it keeps slipping my mind too.
Yeah,
look,
what was it? The Council of Nicaea. Yeah, so basically, there's a number of apocryphal gospels, the so-called apocryphal gospels. Mainly because they didn't fit the political model that was most expedient right there, which was using Christianity as a way to control the masses. So there's a bunch of distortions that got baked in, first of all, by people who were passing down the lore of what Jesus had said or done, and then wanting to put him on more of a pedestal to fit the Messiah mythology of the time. And then you have politicians later who are saying, wow, this is a great way to control the masses, so we've got to do some careful editing of this text so we can use this for political gain. And so basically it's like anything else. It's like somebody has a really great thing, and then it gradually gets co-opted over time or distorted. And so, you know, I think we just have to bear that in mind. I think that personally I feel that Jesus is one of the great historical exemplars of a human divine life, and that we should honor him. But we should also take with a grain of salt the stories that have been passed down and understand that, you know, the distorting influences over time.
Unconditional love, I think that's the key to just about everything.
That's part of why when I'm talking about sacred America, I'm talking about establishing a love relationship with our country, because it's the unconditional love. So we can look into the shadows, we can see the challenges, we can see the breakdowns, we can see the place we've been out of integrity, but we still love our country enough to be really committed to it growing to the next level. Mm-hmm. And that means embracing everybody within our borders, which effectively means every religion of the world. Effectively means every culture. It means every creed. You know, that we are the entire planet in miniature now as a country. And so to really be a true American means to love all of these streams of culture and consciousness and religion from around the world, because we have them all within our borders.
Oh, we got to take a break here. And I think that's one of the key points, unconditional love. Thank you for elaborating on that. It's some things that it's not as popular as it used to be, Stephen. And I'm glad you're going to make sure it gets much more popular. We're dependent on you, Stephen.
And it's partnering with me.
All right, we'll partner with you on that, and look out. Well, we have your back, so to speak, as we used to say in the old days, back here in 1966, 67. And time out here on our playing field, because this station needs to make money like everybody else does these days. Our guest is Stephen Dynan. And the book that we're talking about tonight is extremely important. It's Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All, Hampton Roads Publishing. And you can check him out on theshiftnetwork.com or go to www.sacredamerica.net and you can find out what he's doing in Washington, D.C. He's less than 40 miles down the road right now. So maybe you better go hang out there on his website and see what's going on. We'll be right back. How would you like to win a free copy of the book that we are talking about tonight? Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All by Stephen Dynan and published by Hampton Roads. www.sacredamerica.net. If you know the answer to this trivia question, you will win that book. Do you know who our guest was the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio? You just tell us who our guest was the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio, and you're going to be our winner. And, there are a couple of ways that you can win this book, and that is, give us that answer or send us a check for $150 and we'll send it to you right away. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
On the next 21st Century Radio, the art and science of hand reading and the Monroe Institute programs to explore consciousness and expand awareness. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Hello, this is Stanley Krippner. I'm professor of psychology at Sabre Graduate School in San Francisco on behalf of 21st Century Radio, run by Dr. Bob Hieronymus. And I would certainly encourage listeners to stay tuned because you will hear things on 21st Century Radio that you'll hear nowhere else on the airwaves.
Oh, welcome back. Hey, by the way, you're listening to a dear friend of mine, Chuck Holmes, playing. He's a local musician, and I have a great deal of admiration for him. Dreamscape is what you're listening to now. And we got something else that's probably more important than that, and that is this. We got a deal for you, and the deal is simply this. If you purchase a copy of the book, Sacred America, Sacred World, you can have, and you can prove it. All you need to have is a receipt and let us know. We will allow you to take any book that I've written or my wife has written, or over the last 28 years or 29 years that we've been on the air, we've got books that go back 28 years ago. You can take your choice of any one of them, but you just got to prove that you purchased a copy of this book. And by the way, if you really are going to buy some for other people, we'll give you up to two books if you buy two books. It's that simple. That's how important we think this book is. Do you think your book's that important?
I do. Well,
of
thank
course.
You for...
Of course.
Thank you. You know, I mean, I really wrote this book to be of service to the larger evolution of our day, and so I'm standing on the shoulders of many other people, and I've also been synthesizing a lot of the best thinking in many different areas. So, you know, at Shift Network, we've featured something like 1,000 thought leaders from in all sorts of different areas, from conscious business to holistic health to peace building. And so I've distilled a lot of different strategies. So it goes beyond just the esoteric depth. It goes beyond shifting the political culture. It's really about offering a whole set of solutions and strategies for how do we evolve our country to the next level. So, you know, I've gotten a lot of great feedback, and, you know, I don't feel like it's just me. It's like I've been a synthesizer, and I've been privileged to be, you know, interviewing and in relationship with so many amazing pioneers, and I've distilled the best. So there's a lot of value that comes from hundreds and thousands of people.
You're darn right. Well, like Thomas Paine's book Common Sense galvanized the colonies to come together with what became the American Revolution, your book Sacred America, Sacred World now calls for the American evolution. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Well, the thing with it, with a revolution is it always tends to have a bit of a violent and polarizing edge. So, you know, in the American Revolution, we're obviously violently overthrowing the British rule. And nowadays, we can still get a little too caught up in and romanticizing revolutionary energy. But revolutionary energy tends to be very righteous. It can trend towards more polarization and more violence. It doesn't listen very deeply. So, you know, when you have revolutions, mostly of revolutions that kind of push things backwards in our world politically. And so in America, shifting from being a revolutionary to being an evolutionary is a shift into more patience. It's into more respect. It's more willing to work with whoever, which can include the people who are in mainstream power structures, because mostly what we do when we evolve is we build upon the past. We don't tear down the past and start from scratch. It's not very efficient. It's not how nature works. Nature tends to innovate on top of what has already worked. And so there's a lot about America that has worked and that has been beautiful. And we've got some bugs in the system and we've got some problems we have to deal with. But it doesn't mean tear down the system. It means we need to evolve it to the next level. Mm-hmm. And so that, when using the computer system metaphor, we don't go from America, we don't get to an America 7.0 by deleting all the code from America 1.0 to 6.0, we say, no, there's a lot of good value in that. We want to evolve it to the next level. So the concept with the American evolution is it creates an umbrella or a brand or an idea that people can be a part of regardless of their party affiliation. And that's part of what I feel like is missing right now, is that we're so identified with our parties, and then we start to polarize against people from other parties, that we're not actually grounding ourselves in that unity that I talked about earlier. So the idea is to create an American evolution where you can be an evolutionary Democrat, you can be an evolutionary Republican, you can be an evolutionary Libertarian or an evolutionary Green. It's more about committing to a certain set of principles for how do we conduct ourselves in a way that is growthful, that liberates more of our potential, that comes up with solutions that are innovative and better than anybody could create individually, because they're the product of a lot of collective thinking. So when we're just squabbling with each other and trying to seize power, we're not really thinking together about how to design something better. And part of what I've recognized over time, I used to be more, I would say, on the radical progressive side of things, and eventually learned that I recognized I had a lot to learn from conservatives. There's a lot about personal discipline and responsibility and respect for, you know, being more conservative financially sometimes and creating backup plans, and there's things that conservatives tend to be a little better at than a lot of progressives. They tend to be a little bit better at building large, enduring businesses, for instance. And I've needed to do that with my own company. And so, instead of just critiquing that, I said, "Well, what can I really learn? How can I study and grow?" And it feeds into something what I call political cross training, where we actually become more thoughtful, wise, better leaders by doing some training in whatever political orientation we don't have. So for me, as a progressive, that's meant really apprenticing and learning from conservatives in certain domains, and to really say, I've got something to learn. You know, a great example was my father-in-law, who's no longer with us, but very strong Republican, very tough, and also a very strong businessman. And, you know, he kind of went to battle with me ideologically and CC'd the whole family and friends, and my wife was horrified. But we eventually came to a meeting of men that was a friendship, and eventually asked him to mentor me in business. And you know, without going into the details, he ended up being like this extraordinary mentoring influence. But he was always, you know, it was in this kind of tough guy mode. Like he wasn't just coddling me. He was like challenging me to grow in different ways, and he had a little more of a classical masculine way of grooming somebody for more leadership. And it was good. It was a real value add. I think it helped prepare me to be a better businessman. And so I see that partially as a product of his right-leaning values prioritize, you know, strength and toughness and sort of self-discipline and being able to kind of weather the storms in a deeper way than I was getting from the more new paradigm or spiritual or left-oriented value systems that I was spending time with. So just as you have like a football player who's going to train in ballet so they're a better football player, I think to be a better progressive, it can be useful to really step over the line, think about the world, and look at things from a more conservative orientation. Or you can do it really with any orientation. You can think about it from a more libertarian perspective or green. And that actually strengthens eventually your understanding of issues because you could talk about them then from multiple directions.
Yes, of course.
I can give one example that's kind of people find interesting is right now, Bernie Sanders really helped to popularize the notion of the $15 an hour minimum wage, which I think is an important vision for us to hold of having a healthy floor to the wage that, so people can actually live in a way that there, it's more of a not just a bare minimum, barely existing life, but to actually, have a reasonable life. And so the thing with when somebody's being paid $7 an hour and they actually can't raise their family with that, they can't cover their health care, they need to have subsidized food in the form of food stamps. They often need subsidized rent or housing. So those subsidies all come from other taxpayers. So effectively what we're doing is we're allowing companies to pay somebody below what it takes for them to live, and then we're having other taxpayers subsidize them through a government, which then creates a layer of bureaucracy. So raising the minimum wage can be about shrinking the size of government. It can be about increasing self-responsibility, decreasing the size of government and decreasing the taxpayer subsidizing companies as well. So those are all like more right-oriented priorities. And if you talk about the $15 an hour minimum wage from that perspective, it opens up a different conversation than if it's just from a left-oriented perspective.
Good advice, really good advice. I've had to go to a lot of very conservative people to make sure I didn't lose my shirt a couple of times.
The what?
I had to go to a lot of very conservative people in the past to make sure I didn't drop the ball on the 2-yard line and getting my work done.
Exactly, yeah.
Because they knew systems that I had no idea that they even existed. And it was quite something. I just like with you and your relationship with your dad or stepdad, you gained great admiration, at least I did. Great admiration for them in another way, and it can change their whole entire relationship with them the rest of your life. Yeah. And I'm being told I'm getting time.
It's basically applying the same principle that, what's made us great in so many ways as a nation is that we've allowed a great diversity of viewpoints and culture, and we've allowed a diversity of religious orientation. And so that diversity actually is more generative of novelty in evolution. So the more novelty you have, as long as it works in a synergistic way rather than a destructive way, it actually allows the engine of progress to happen. So that's
and we have a little bit of diversity here to pay for our station at the top of the hour. Listen to the news, and we'll be right back with our guest Stephen Dynan, Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All, Hampton Roads Publishing, www.sacredamerica.net.
On Talk Radio 680, WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio.
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus and Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
Oh, listen to Bob Dylan there. George Harrison. Hear him? That's the Traveling Wilburys. Never met them, didn't hang out with them. However, I can tell you this, they're my favorite band, period. Extraordinary people. And our guest, by the way, we've got a deal going on here. And the deal is this. We have found the book that we think everyone in this country, at least, should own and read. And I think it even this is the kind of book I'd like to see in high school libraries as well. It's called Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All, Hampton Roads Publishing. And it's authored by Stephen Dynan. And I am truly impressed by this fella. He's really, well, he's quite something. And the deal is this. You buy a copy of this book, and you can prove it to us, then you just let us know whatever book you want from what we've read or written or have had on the air for the past 29 years, and it's yours. Just have to prove it. That's how important it is, because it is that important. Our country needs to come together and reunite. And then I do believe we can work out all these other problems, especially when you start using unconditional love, which I think is really the key to all those things. And please go to www.sacredamerica.net, because we had learned last hour that Stephen is in Washington, D.C. in neighborhood tomorrow, and he's in D.C. right now, and you'll be able to go to that website, www.sacredamerica.net, check out what he's doing, and join him if you can. If you can't, then buy his book. It's that simple. All right, Stephen, you're with us.
Thank you, Bob. You know, during the break, I actually looked up Hieronymus means sacred name. So we have a kind of interesting resonance between your name and the book.
Yes, it's true. That's very, very funny. There's a lot of parallels between what you do and myself and you and me. I mean, there are. And especially, you know, I wish I could spend some time in San Francisco. I just had some of the best times of my life out there. And one of the few places for 30 some years ago, I could go back and go outside and talk to anybody just about in the world on reincarnation, because everyone else knows a little bit about this, that, these, and those. That's terrific.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's lovely about San Francisco is it's sort of it's like a diffusion point for new innovation that's coming into our world. And so, you know, it happens in social movements, whether it's the Beats or the hippies or, you know, gay rights movement, or it happens within technology. There's there's a kind of a culture of innovation. And so, you know, I think that's part of one of the things that we actually need to bring into how we're thinking about politics as well, because part of the critique of the right, which is quite justified, is that government can be really bog things down. There's the big bureaucracy, slow moving. And I think there's a validity in that critique that we need to address. But it's not just about shrinking government to, you know, the size, I think Grover Norquist said, the size that you could drown in a bathtub, but really to create a government that is more streamlined and more innovative as well. So one of the things I talk about in the book is this idea for solutions councils. And solutions councils are sort of like the skunk works in a company, where you have a branch of the company that's designed to think about the future and innovate outside of delivering on the products of today. So in government now, we tend, like the people we've elected, first of all, they have to spend in Congress 4 hours a day fundraising on average, so that they're already spending a lot of time fundraising, and just trying to get up to speed on the existing things on their table can be overwhelming. The same thing is true at really state government levels, local government levels. So there's not a lot of time to track the world and see what the best innovations are happening. So the idea with the Solutions Council would be, you can have a Baltimore Solutions Council, you could have a Maryland Solutions Council, or you could have a White House Solutions Council. It's essentially like a panel of people who are experts in their domain, whose only job is to basically scan the larger landscape for innovations that are worth knowing about. It could be in criminal justice, it could be in healthcare, it could be in how do we have different programs in our education system. And the reason this is so important is that because of the pace of our culture keeps accelerating, we're going faster, change is happening faster and faster in our culture as a whole. So our government needs to get to be able to grow faster as well. We need to be able to propagate innovation much more quickly. And so Solutions Council would be in connection with each other. So the Maryland Solutions Council might be in connection with this California Solutions Council, and the people are like, hey, you check out what we just implemented in terms of social and emotional education for kids, there's this whole toolbox program. It's amazing. We're getting great results. So you propagate that laterally more. So you kind of ping-pong the innovations around the world much more quickly that way, and then you have a function built in to feed that into the local, state, or national governments. And so it makes it brings an element of the business sensibility into the political process to make it more nimble and make it more agile and make it more innovative.
Voting. How did it happen that many Americans not only don't vote, but they leave things to the very politicians they decry? How did we get to this point?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors in that, and you know, I think that one thing that I was talking about in terms of proactive solution, Joan Blades and I, she was one of the founders of Move On. She had the idea of holding high schools accountable, rating them on the degree of democratic participation of their graduating seniors.
Wow.
So I thought this was a really interesting role
for us. Yeah.
We've kind of gotten accustomed to thinking of, well, okay, the people fresh out of high school, they have the lowest voting rates, right? We just assume that that's the way it should be. When in actuality, one of the original reasons for public schooling was to train more educated citizens. There was a recognition that democracy functioned better with more educated people. So it wasn't just for their benefit. It was also to ensure that we had more wisdom in how the country was run. And so we test people on all these other measures of success, and we're tracking their all kinds of things about kids coming out of school, but we don't really track voting records. And, you know, why not say that part of the goal of high school is to inspire kids to become really passionately engaged as citizens? Because once people start to vote, they tend to keep up the habit. And so, in their 20s, people can be slow on the uptake, or they can get completely disillusioned and drop out of the process altogether. So we want to build that habit early and often, because it's ultimately empowering. It's like when we vote, it's like we know we're affecting the course of our own destiny, we're affecting the course of our own country. And so, you know, inaction can have its own momentum as well. And so we want to, and I think that's one angle, is like sort of helping to build in more incentives, more celebration, more modeling into the high school culture, so that, you know, we're getting kids voting for young adults voting at a higher rate. And I think there's also this element, part of why I really wanted to speak to this spiritual current, is that part of the reason people turn away from politics is because they perceive that the culture itself is very toxic, and it becomes a self-reinforcing thing, as you're saying, is if they're not bringing their energy and creativity and ingenuity in, and then they kind of withdraw, then it actually leads to a decline in the system further, and then it perpetuates the whole system. So instead, we have to reverse that pattern. We've got to bring ourselves into the political process, but bring all of ourselves. Bring our heart, bring our love, bring our spirituality. We're going to be doing events. One of the things I want to do with my book tour is we're doing events where we have devotional singing, we've got kirtan, we're going to do poetry reading, and we're going to talk politics. Because it's more about like, hey, politics can be an amazing, fascinating, beautiful experience if we bring all of ourselves into it and we make it more juicy and fun and lively. So why should a political-oriented event be all dry? It can be fun, it can be celebratory, it can be ecstatic. And so, you know, that's part of what I want to template in with my book as well, as and part of connected to what you said before about the American evolution. I think to really design an American evolution that works, it's got to be something that really is juicy and enlivening, and you come away more hopeful. So some of the best feedback I've gotten about the book so far have been people said, you know, I've been totally disillusioned with the whole political process, and this really reconnected me with my love for America and my hope for the future. You know, just those two things. But then you got to put it into action. It's like, because actions are themselves are positive reinforcers. So then it can't just sit at home and twiddle your thumbs and keep watching the news and getting depressed by it. You got to take the little actions that make a difference. You got to reach across divides, whether that's, you know, going down to your local mosque after a terrorist incident and saying, you know, we love and embrace you, or going to work in an inner city, or working, spending some time in a jail. You know, my wife has done that, and it's been tremendously healing and liberating, actually, to do that. And, you know, just crossing divides. This last night ended up just with to two black women and a white woman and myself, and we'd had like a really deep racial healing kind of conversation. And just there's something so simple about it that I had been kind of really feeling like, well, how do I engage this week? Like the horror, the news that's been coming out. And this woman, particularly one of the two black women, she just really spoke truth of like, what has her experience been like as an African American and the history and it made me cry, and it was really profound, and we were just hugging and loving each other up afterwards, and it was just there was a real recognition of like just that, even without taking a further action, just that of like a deep listening and like by two people, like black and white, deeply listening to each other, is in itself a profound healing. And then, you know, it's natural that we want to do other things to help heal things on the cultural level, but it's a major shadow issue for our culture. It's erupting right now in a big way, and each of us can be part of the solution with as simple of a thing as just creating a living room conversation to create some healing around race and the legacy of slavery in particular. And you know.
Well, one of your bold suggestions is that we dissolve the Federal Reserve and move to state-owned banks. And you cite the success of North Dakota, and I was not aware of this. That's one of the good reasons why I wanted to bring it up, which has a very healthy economy thanks to this, and not just to oil and fracking, as is widely reported. How can that work in dissolving the Federal Reserve and move more to state-owned banks?
Well, I mean, there's really kind of a deeper principle involved in this. It's important, first of all, to think about. It's like, money is it's a social contract. We're basically exchanging a form of promissory notes saying, you know, I give you this, and this is going to have a certain value, and this is symbolic for an exchange of value between people. So it's a social contract, and to have the profit from a social contract go to private interests, it actually doesn't make logical sense. And the way things are designed, when you create money in a private way and then loan it into the public at interest, it also creates scarcity and debt and cycles of debt that need to be repaid and introduces some distortions into the system. So, you know, when you think about the Federal Reserve is sort of cleverly named, but it's not really federal and it's not really reserve. It's basically the private consortium of banks that are able to essentially create money out of nothing and then charge you for that service. and so, you know, so it's when you really wake up to what's going on, sort of baffling that we don't wake up to it earlier, because
that's right.
You know, you have these giant granite buildings that seem very imposing, but underneath it's sort of like the shell game. And so, it's very difficult, you know, to change the Federal Reserve right away. I don't think that's the first step at all, because there's so many vested interests. It's a really complicated business. But to hold in our head that actually to design our society in a really healthy way so the economy flows and works for everybody, we eventually have to kind of take back our right as a people to create our own money supply that benefits the people, not private interests. But that principle is finding this great expression in, there are now city-owned banks. There's also Bank of North Dakota is probably the best example. But there's other examples like Guernsey Island, which was at one time a province of Britain. They have their own public banking system. So the concept is that it doesn't mean you knock private banks out of business. So in North Dakota, there's still, you know, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, whatever. They've got branches of their operations there. But there's a public bank that is owned by the public and basically creates loans and infrastructure projects and helps to improve the overall economy. And when it does well, it returns the money. And if there's profits, actually gets returned to taxpayers as well. And so it acts as a complementary system to the private banking system. And it also helps to infuse money into needed public works and public projects. And it's North Dakota, basically in 2008 and 2009, it weathered the downturn or the Great Recession in a much better way than any other state in the country, partially because of the Bank of North Dakota. So there's a whole movement around for public banking now. If you just search for public banking on the web, you can find it and be part of it. And what's remarkable about to me is not just that this innovation is happening, and not just happening here, but there's I think there's a dozen or more countries around the world that are experimenting with public banking now too. But that most political leaders don't know anything about it, because it's sort of one of those fundamental things. And this is where the whole idea of solutions councils comes back. And you need to have a mechanism to get innovations like this to propagate. Because, you know, when North Dakota's having this kind of success, their economy's booming, taxpayers are saving money, and it's also just greasing the wheels of the whole system, and the whole economy is much healthier. And you got collapsing infrastructure in the rest of the country. People need to know about that, but the story doesn't break. So you need to propagate the story, and then to really create the experiment of how do we create more public banks from the grassroots up so that we are owning this money creation power. I was talking to Gavin Newsom, who's the running for governor in California, and he had never heard of the whole Bank of North Dakota, and he was like, yeah, we really need to look into this. And
yeah.
So there's some awareness raising, and there's just getting involved in this, because it's the kind of thing that also can be very unifying between left and right as well, because there's oftentimes a lot of libertarians or Rand Paul followers or Ron Paul and Rand Paul. There's definitely been a recognition that there's a deep issue with the Federal Reserve, but it hasn't been as simply articulated in the strategy, and it tends to focus just on the Federal Reserve. But instead, if you build from the grassroots up, you can actually start to shift the whole money supply and system in a more positive, society-affirming way that without destroying any of the private system, but you're just creating this public system in parallel.
Well, that's terrific. That really is, because when you noted that it's not a federal system and they make the money, and then you get charged for it, and they make all kinds of money on making the money.
Right.
And something's wrong there, and that's the reason why. And I was so surprised to see what's going on there in North Dakota. Now, in addition to prosperity, you also write on how we can have peace, even in the Middle East, and how each of us can contribute. Everyone from Jimmy Carter to Obama has tried. What can individual Americans do about this?
Well, one of the things that I've thought is, there's some big picture policies that I go into the book about, like, how do we as a country shift our alliances? So we're primarily seeing ourselves as a stabilizer and building alliances rather than backing one player in war against another. So there's some high-level policies that I go into different aspects. But I think on a personal level, one of the things that we can do is think about how do we can be emissaries across divides. And so one of the biggest divides right now is obviously the Islamic world in the West. There's a lot of tension. There's a lot of discrimination. There's a lot of alienation. There's some real polarization happening there that's dangerous and leads to a lot of destruction. So there's a website called Kiva.org, which is the premier microfinance one-to-one matching organization for it. You can basically make small loans to developing world entrepreneurs. So the reason this is so important is, let's say that you're in Pakistan and you're exposed to a bunch of anti-American sentiment. You're kind of seeing America as sort of a negative empire that's really dominating the world. And it's like you're more prone to be seduced into essentially a proto-terrorist ideology. However, if you have the microloan model, it's like there's a woman in the village and wants to create a sewing business, and she's getting a $1,500 loan from 25 Americans, $25 bucks each, who are giving her the loan to start get her little sewing business off the ground, and she's able to start feeding her family, and then she starts developing that further, and she's employing several people. There's a whole other story then that's getting told to friends and allies. It's like, wow, I feel really grateful to the Americans because they're helping me get off the ground. They're helping me to thrive. And the beauty of these microloans is you don't actually lose any money for the most part, is that 98 to 99% of the loans are repaid. So you can be circulating your loans over and over again over time. I just have a couple thousand dollars that get reloaned to different people. And I like to focus on Islamic areas because I feel like it's a little message from me to somebody in an Islamic country that says, hey, I care about you. I honor you. I want you to thrive. And that's going to be far more effective and far cheaper as a form of foreign policy than a lot of the military posturing. So these little acts of giving people a hand up and little signals that we care about you and that we want your life, we want you to prosper and thrive as well. And what's great about microfinance is it tends to also transcend party lines too. It's like Democrats love it, Republicans love it. Democrats love it because it's empowering oftentimes people who have been disenfranchised or unbanked, and particularly women. Republicans tend to love it because it's about getting people on their feet. It's not giving them a handout. It's giving them a hand up so that they can build their own business. So it's very entrepreneurial. So I advocate for really building this into our individual lives, and just it's very easy to do. You can set up an account in 5 minutes and start making little loans to different people. And it's kind of fun because you see the pictures of, you know, the entrepreneurs that you're loaning to, and you can choose different countries. And then we could actually build this in more into our national policy, so that instead of, if you gradually reduce the defense budget by 2% a year and started putting that into microfinance funds for developing world entrepreneurs, that would be a great catalyst for the uplifting of people, as well as a way to really become more secure, because then we have much people feeling much better about the United States than currently, where they might have had somebody get taken out in their village by a drone bomb or something.
Wow, what an excellent strategy. You've got one great idea after another, Stephen. I want to thank you for joining us. We are out of time, unfortunately. We have learned a great deal from you. And friends, again, you know what the deal is. Get a couple copies of this book, and we'll give you a couple of copies of our books, because we want everyone to read this important work. Congratulations, Stephen. It's really been an honor talking with you.
Oh, terrific. I mean, I feel we're really like-minded, and I just honor you for doing the work you're doing with this show.
Yep. Well, that's our karma, and that's your karma, I'm certain. We chose this to do this, and I greatly appreciate the fact that all conditional, unconditional love is a key to just about, I think, everything you do.
Amen. I mean, you're that's speaking my language.
Well, thank you, and we'll be seeing you in apple blossom time, maybe even before that. Hey, by the way, friends, Patricia Wirth, Executive Director of Turning Point Suffragist Memorial, will be joining us in a few minutes.